Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman Deep Dive, the podcast that explores the ideas behind the news.
People are racing against the machine, and many of them are losing that race.
The impact of technology on employment is one of those subterranean issues that has the potential to completely shake up our politics, like we need any more shaking up.
We're going to see more and more things that look like science fiction, and fewer things that look like jobs.
Jobs, who does them, how many there are to go round, how we feel about doing them, are absolutely fundamental to society. And digital technology may change the job market more radically than at any point since the Industrial Revolution.
They work for one of the UK's fastest growing tech companies, but are in protest over pay.
We're here working 7 days a week for Deliveroo. We're out here all day, all night, working.
Robots of some kind or another are already doing a lot of jobs, once done by human beings, like shop assistants, accountants, and the Prime Minister. But we're really only at the beginning. Here's a quote from the leader of a big UK employer at a recent summit organised by the Times. "We're not actually in the business of employing people. We're in the business of doing business. And the likelihood is that the demand for employment will go down." So that's Charlie Mayfield, who's the chairman of John Lewis. And, you know, he's talking not just about John Lewis, but about the whole economy. The demand for employment will go down. So on this week's deep dive, we'll be talking about what it means for politics when the demand for employment goes down. And I'm delighted to say that we'll be doing so with the help of a special guest, Sarah O'Connor of the Financial Times. Before we turn to Sarah, I want to say hello to my co-host, Stuart Wood.
Hello, Ian, again.
I guess the sort of job of a peer is not going to be... You can't be replaced by a robot, can you? I mean, surely your work is just too...
It's too valuable.
Exactly. Nobody else can, you know, sit on a bench and fall asleep. You know, you can't program an algorithm to do that. You need a human being.
No, I agree. You need a huge amount of wisdom, talent and patronage to be able to do what I do. Exactly right.
What are your observations about what's going on with our just about managing Prime Minister at the moment?
Well, I think the fascinating development is this pact with the DUP, which you might think is constitutionally essential, because without it, you don't get a majority and therefore you won't be able to govern. But I think it's going to be such a poison chalice for the Conservative Party for two reasons. One is, I declare my interest. I used to be Northern Ireland advisor to Gordon Brown, but I do think that whatever the intentions, whatever they profess, it will have a pretty destructive impact on the perception of the government's ability to be an honest broker in Northern Ireland. And it's not as though Northern Ireland is not in crisis. It's actually multiple crises at the moment. And crises are going to get worse with Brexit, because as we all know, Northern Ireland is one of the Achilles heels of the Brexit project. So there's that problem. But there's also a party political problem for them, which is the DUP. Look, I know some of these people very well. They're very honourable people. They're very principled, incredibly canny negotiators. And their politics has been...
Yeah, it's at least good practice for Brexit to negotiate with the DUP, because they are...
That's true. It's like a training exercise. That's true. That's definitely right. But they are very, very socially conservative, and a pact with the DUP coming in the wake of an election that has revealed a potentially catastrophic problem the Tories have with under 40s, with millennials and not even millennials, I think the jarring between those two things, allying yourself to a very socially conservative party at a time when you've got to reach out to people who are not looking at retirement down the line very soon, that's a real political problem for the Conservative Party. And they are now joined at the hip every day this government survives, and that is a real problem for them.
So many problems. We've gone from sort of the Labour Party is in terminal decline to the Tories are in terminal decline within the space of weeks. But here at the Deep Dive, we like to look at the underlying issue, the deeper issues, if you like, that are governing our political debate. So let's turn to this question of technology and employment. Do you think this is an issue for the left, or who do you think it hurts more, or which do you think has a greater opportunity, the left or the right, when it comes to dealing with this?
Well, I think one of the ironies is that the left, I mean, the last 200 years of leftiness in Europe has largely revolved around work and releasing people from the oppressiveness of work. If you look at Marx, looking at Marx this morning, as I do, obviously every morning I read a bit of Karl Marx. And you know, famously, there's only two pages in Marx's entire canon of work which actually describes what communist society looks like.
Oh, yeah, no, so at which point he sort of coughs and moves on.
Exactly, to, and when he was forced not to cough, and I've got it here, he says, in communist society, where no one has an exclusive sphere of activity, each can become accomplished in any branch he wishes, I will be able to hunt in the morning, fish in the afternoon, rear cattle in the evening, criticise after dinner. And that's often sort of parodied, that passage.
It does sound like a description of the metropolitan elite.
It does, apart from the cattle bit.
You know.
But actually, there is a potential, this agenda of automation and robots, and releasing people to have full and fulfilling lives. And the left, I think, should be embracing that. But the left has also come to define a job as the mark of human decency, not just the left, but more generally.
Yeah.
And the really interesting reaction is the left at the moment is, I think, quite scared of robots, automation, and the effect it's going to have. And I personally think slightly overreacting, but we'll discuss that with our expert in a minute, Sarah.
Well, indeed, we should turn to our special guest with no further ado. Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
Sarah O'Connor is a columnist and reporter for the FT who has established a reputation for some of the best reporting and most incisive thinking in this area. So we're very glad to have her here. Stuart, do you want to...
Yeah, Sarah, I just wanted to kick off by asking you about how different this particular revolution is to all the other revolutions that have happened in every decade for the last 150 years. I mean, economists every generation, there's a branch of commentary that says, oh, this technology is going to change everything. It's going to displace human activity and human employment. And then it doesn't. Or maybe it does and we just adapt. I mean, is there something different about the current obsession with automation and robots changing the nature of work that's different to those previous
waves? Is it different
waves?
To Luddites, yeah.
So I do think it is fundamentally different. I mean, if you go back through time and look at, you know, headlines from the New York Times in the 1920s, loads of the headlines had things like the march of the machines, robots to destroy work. You know, these things are things that we've worried about intensely for ages, and with good reason. I mean, it's not that we should be relaxed about it. I think AI and robotics will be transformative, but the light bulb was transformative, the steam engine was transformative, trains were transformative, and none of them lead ultimately to mass unemployment. And I don't think there's any reason to think that this time would lead to mass unemployment. I mean, if you want the kind of case that people make for why it would, if you read people like Martin Ford, who wrote this very kind of apocalyptic book about robots, he basically says that AI will be so good that it will just be able to do everything, like literally everything a human could do, a robot will learn how to do better. But actually, when you talk to the people who are doing AI and doing robotics, they just say that the notion that that could happen is like a million miles away from where we are now. Mm. I mean, last night I went and met an incredibly human-like robot called Sophia. I mean, I'll show you a video later. She was kind of creepily human. But when you try and talk to her, you know, it's like talking to someone with brain damage. You know, she's all over the place. And we're nowhere near there yet. I mean, if the kind of the so-called singularity where you create a robot that has sort of general human intelligence, I think at that point, all bets are off. But even the people at Google DeepMind will tell you that we're nowhere near there.
Okay, so maybe a different way of looking at it is, and I know you do look at this in your work quite a lot, is the effect that technology is having on humans and the way they do their jobs and the way they have to do their jobs. And in a way, the problem is, not necessarily humans being replaced by robots, but the workplace being organized around technology in a way that turns human beings into robots, makes them kind of do things by, you know, enforces routine and method in a way that takes away kind of human initiative and creativity.
Another Karl Marx favorite topic, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, right, of course.
So, I mean, that kind of trend started with this thing called scientific management around the turn of the dawn of real big factories, where this guy, Taylor, got a stopwatch and realized that he could measure kind of every action of every man in a factory and figure out the most efficient way that it should be done. And then basically break all work down into these little tasks and tell people how to do them and basically turn men into machines. And I guess one of the threats that I see with the kind of blossoming of some of this new technology is that you can basically do Taylorism on steroids. You know, you can do it to an extent that was never possible before. You can manage people and really control what they're doing, even if they're not in a factory, even if they're an Uber driver or a Deliveroo courier. You can still kind of watch everything they're doing and making sure that they're doing it to your precise kind of specifications. And that just has implications for, do we enjoy work? Does it mean anything to us? And those, I think, are the most important questions to ask.
Which sectors are being transformed or have been most transformed by the AI revolution so far? I mean, we've got used over the last 50 years to robots replacing humans in manufacturing of cars and things like that. So that's not particularly new. But are there particular sectors, like maybe service sectors, or what are the areas where AI is really changing dramatically the character and the balance of work?
So the areas where you're starting to see it creep in are things like law. So there are now quite a few of the big fancy law firms are investing in their own AI to do the kinds of things that junior lawyers used to do, staying up all night, reading through like reams of documents, looking for dodgy clauses when there's a big M&A transaction looming. They're now developing AI that can read through all that stuff very quickly and pick out, it can understand natural language and sometimes multiple languages, and then flag up to the more senior lawyers, these are the bits you need to look at. So there's stuff in kind of law and accountancy and that sort of thing. And then the other sort of really big one is what's going to happen to driving, trucking, you know, if all of that becomes autonomous, then that's obviously a huge disruption.
But it's interesting, that from those examples, it's not just the less skilled that are having replacement effects, actually. It could go all the way up into well-paid professions.
Absolutely. And you know, I think one of the kind of interesting challenges of all this is, do we need to kind of reappraise what we mean by skill? Mm-hmm. You know, I met an accountant recently who said, hang on, I'm more replaceable than someone who works in a nursing home. Am I still more skilled than her? If what I can do is done by a robot and what she can do can't. Mm-hmm. I think it definitely would have a sort of different distributional effect.
That's really interesting. Especially the comparison with nursing homes and social care, because that's an area where it's very difficult to replace, you know, perhaps impossible to replace human beings. And so the productivity gains that you get from automation are concentrated in certain areas of the private sector, but they're not really going to help with the public sector, as far as I can see, because you can't really.
So Japan is trying really hard to introduce robots into things like elderly care, because Japan has this perfect storm of a really, really old and aging population, a shrinking population, zero immigration, because Japan just doesn't tolerate large amounts of immigration. And so they really need to know, how on earth are we going to look after these old people? So they are building little robots that will keep old people company. But I went to Japan recently and met one, and it was the most irritating thing.
Oh, why? Like, what was it like?
It was like this little tabletop robot that was meant to be very cute, had very big eyes, but its job is to remind you to take your pills at certain points. And I just thought, actually, if you left me alone with this all day, I would like throw it on the floor, take the batteries out or something.
So Sophia yesterday beat the Japanese robot, you think, in terms of personability and...
No, she creeped me out as well, actually. Maybe I just don't like robots.
Won't AI, like other technological innovations, create a new cadre of jobs, like to service the machines? And I mean, are we seeing job creation in these ancillary services, in just, you know, greasing the wheels and doing all the things to keep the machines and the AI up to speed?
Yeah, definitely. And that's something I've been meaning to write more about, actually. So with AI, the kind of crucial thing that makes AI good or bad is, how much data can you get to train it on? And who do you get to train it? You need to kind of train these algorithms to like learn from their mistakes and to learn from a human who kind of plugs in a bit of input. So there are jobs being created in AI training, and they're not even necessarily high-skilled jobs. Some of them are just people like stay-at-home mums who log onto an app and do a bit of AI training for a few hours in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. There's also just like more basic things. So there are delivery companies like Hermes that are developing little robot deliverers. And at the minute, every robot has its own robot walker, which is just a man who walks behind the robot and makes sure it doesn't like fall off the curb.
That's my next job.
But frankly, okay, those jobs are not going to last that long, only until the technology gets a bit better.
I mean, yeah. Presumably a robot to walk the robot at some point as well.
Exactly.
Okay. When you're talking to, I mean, you've done some great reporting on companies like Uber and Deliveroo, where you talk to the people who are employed, well, I don't know if I can use that term, but, you know, who Uber drivers, Deliveroo drivers. How did you find that they were experiencing being sort of organized, their work schedule being organized by algorithm? What was your kind of overall impression of the way they felt about that, the way they experienced it?
So there was a mixture, I would say. Like, I think people who kind of blanket criticize the gig economy are probably making a mistake, because there's a reason that people are doing this. And actually, a lot of the people who I talk to who are working as Uber drivers or whatever it might be, they used to have traditional jobs and they hated them. And one of the things they hated was the kind of capriciousness of their human boss, who would look over their shoulder, give them shifts or not give them shifts, depending on whether they liked their face or not. And actually they accepted that actually they were still under a lot of control, but they preferred the facelessness of the algorithm to the kind of reality of a human breathing down their necks. So in some ways, I think they genuinely feel like it is a bit of a release. But that said, there's still massive frustrations with the algorithms, and particularly the fact that they're not very flexible. So someone might have a bad experience in your Uber car that's actually not your fault at all. Maybe there was just awful traffic, but they're cross when they get out, so they give you a one-star rating. But Uber doesn't know why you got a one-star rating. And once your ratings drop below, you know, 3... And they just, I mean, they can't sack you because you're not an employee, but they deactivate you. This is like the new
deactivate.
The new vocabulary.
They open your chest up and undo the wires.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, things like that, I think people do find troubling. And those are the sorts of areas that we're going to have to think about a lot more.
Are there wider ethical issues which, as a society, we haven't even started to think about here, about particularly with robots that learn and then innovate and make judgments? I mean, we haven't even begun, have we, to think about the regulatory problems that poses or the ethical dilemmas it poses, and who the responsible bodies are going to be to start addressing these things.
Yeah, I mean, these are the sorts of things I think we need to worry about before we worry about whether all the jobs are going to disappear, is these questions of responsibility and that sort of thing. If you think about a robo-lawyer who makes a mistake,
yeah,
who do you sue? Do you sue the law firm that was using it? Do you sue the creator of the AI? Similarly with, you know, lots of journalism now is being done by pretty basic kind of AI that will do simple reports. What if they get something wrong that then means that someone trades on it and makes a loss? Who do you sue? So I think there are big problems around that. And then with autonomous cars, the big question people are now talking about is, if your autonomous car is presented with a situation where it either swerves and kills the passengers, or it keeps going and kills the people in front of it, which does it choose? You know, these are like moral judgments about life and death, but we're going to hand them over to a AI.
Will you be able to choose which kind of car you go into based on that choice? Yeah. It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, although when we compare it to drive, we often forget that how bad human beings are at driving or doing tasks, right?
Yeah.
So human beings make different kinds of mistakes, but they make mistakes too. So you're basically comparing, you know, which kind of set of mistakes do you prefer in which context?
Yeah, and it might be humans almost certainly will make more mistakes than machines, but is there a qualitative difference? Like, do we feel happier about a human mistake than a automated one?
And just getting, you know, to the political question and the policy question, what are the just in broad terms, what are the possible responses that we can make to what's going on? You know, or at least what are the ones that you've seen that you go, well, okay, that sounds like it has potential to address some of these issues?
So one of the things that lots of people say, which must surely be true, but hasn't worked brilliantly in the last 20, 30 years, is we need to think more carefully about education. So if robots and AI will be able to do more things, we need to think, how do we educate people so that they are better at doing the things that the robots won't be able to do? Or how do we make them more resilient or more creative or more adaptable? And those are obviously good questions to ask. But I think, you know, we've been hoping that education is the answer to all of the economy's problems for a long time, and we haven't really got it right so far. I mean, that's also the response that we make when, you know, there's sort of rust belts appear. As we say, okay, we need to reskill and retrain these people, and
all these
coal miners can be coders and it'll all be fine. And it hasn't worked so far. So that has to be part of the solution. I don't know if it can really do everything, not least because we don't know what the skills of the future are going to be. Exactly, so how can we predict and tell a five-year-old something that they're going to need in 20 years? And then obviously, if you want to kind of take the extreme view, and this actually appeals to people on the extreme of the right and the left, you get into the conversation about a universal basic income. And do you actually accept that a lot of people won't be able to have jobs in this new economy? And therefore, we need to think radically about how do we make sure that everyone still has a decent standard of living and kind of separate the link between having a job and having decent living standards.
So I'm a bit of a skeptic on basic income, I guess, for two reasons. One is, politically, breaking the link between effort and reward, I think, is politically going to make it very, very vulnerable to attack when things go wrong.
I can't imagine the Daily Mail readers.
Yeah, exactly.
But
that's a reason not to do it.
Isn't one of the arguments for it that everyone gets it, therefore, you know, you're not sort of demonising one group of people who can't get a job, and you know, but you kind of remove that
you
dynamic.
You remove the stigma.
You remove the stigma.
One
exactly.
of the arguments for it, yeah. But I guess there's a practical problem with it, which is that unless you want to tax people a hell of a lot more, which some people will go along with, but a lot of people won't, you're fundamentally going to have to redistribute what benefits are already going out to people, and that means taking some benefits away from people that are getting lots, i.e. people who are heavily disabled, and giving them to people like me and you who have jobs and don't need it. And that is that just on a practical level, that's very difficult.
But there are some experiments now around the world, right, in basic income. I think the Finns are doing something on it, aren't they?
The Finns are doing something. So I think it's been kind of mislabeled. They're calling it a basic income trial, but it's not really a purist one. So what they're doing is they're giving money to unemployed people without any conditions. So they don't have to prove that they're looking for a job, for example.
Right.
So, I mean, that is an interesting experiment, but it's not. They're not giving money to everyone, whether they've got a job or not. You were talking about the left and how it feels about some of this stuff. I was at a kind of trade union conference a few months ago of trade unions around Europe, and they were feeling deeply sceptical about universal basic income. I suspect it feels like an existential threat to trade unions.
I think my second source of scepticism about it, apart from the politics of it, is that it's an argument often made by technology fetishists who want to kind of salve their conscience about the displacement effects that technology is going to have. And I think you get a lot of tech heads saying, please, can the government support this so that we can be free to make our billions and concentrate income more? So I'm just slightly dubious to the agenda of the advocates of it.
It means you don't have to think about how you're organising your workplace, or how you, because you just say, well, we'll just take care of this, right? Yeah. It's a very sort of simple answer, isn't it?
This is my biggest reservation with it, is I feel like, as you say, it's a get-out-of-jail-free card for all employers.
Exactly.
That they don't have to feel that they have any responsibility anymore to provide people with stability of income or decency, that actually you're free to do whatever you want, give people tiny scraps of work here or there, that's fine, it's nothing to do with you anymore. And of course, Silicon Valley loves that idea. Mm. Because that's the kind of work they want to design. But actually, that's a massive responsibility to decide that employers don't have anymore.
Yeah. Britain is a world leader in AI, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah.
King's Cross is the place.
Yeah, we're really, really good at it. Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, that's good to know.
That's my next job sorted then.
Yeah, exactly. They'll never replace the podcast industry with AI, will they? Sarah, that was absolutely fascinating. Really interesting.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
We end these podcasts with a rant or rave. Today is our first philosophy rant from Ian Leslie.
I'm going to rave about an essay which you can find online. It's called Anger and the Politics of Blame. I think that's what it's called. It's by Martha Nussbaum, American philosopher. And it is just a fantastic read. So you need to put aside, 20 minutes to read it because it's quite long. It's a few thousand words. But I guarantee that you'll find it really interesting and it'll basically make you a better person. It is about the role of anger in politics and democracy more generally. And she argues incredibly eloquently and powerfully that the anger is ultimately poisonous to democracy. And that it has a role in politics, but what tends to be, because, you want people to get angrier, you want people to be outraged, right, at moral injustice, right? That's a good thing. But it almost always ends up in retribution. Anger becomes this kind of way of paying back people for what they've done. And the way she frames it is by saying, anger becomes backward-looking very quickly. It's about let's get those people for something they've done in the past, rather than forward-facing, looking into the future. And she kind of looks at some examples, central examples of Martin Luther King, where she talks about the way that he, he had a lot to be angry about, right? And he was very kind of careful to say, I don't believe in retribution. So it was the kind of Malcolm X debate, really. Because actually we need black and white people in America to live together happily. So he was thinking about the future all the time, rather than saying these people have inflicted this terrible injustice on us, therefore we must pay them back, because that wouldn't have worked if you want to a cooperative society.
The thing is that a lot of movements are combinations of the two, right? From, progressive movements in the United States to civil rights to Brexit, they bundle together hope and optimism about a different future and fury at the status quo. And I just wonder whether it's possible to distinguish between the two. I guess also there are certain things in politics which tend to lend themselves towards the more optimistic future looking way of thinking, like manifestos in elections, for example, right? And there are certain things like prime minister's questions, which are basically anger, take lumps out of your opponent time. Yeah. So there's a place for different elements in these politics. I just wonder encourage one rather than the other. It's a tricky one. But
what I think is happening at the moment, and the reason this essay kind of spoke to me so powerfully, was that what I see when I see the way politics is discussed, and social media, Twitter has undoubtedly had a big role in this, is a huge amount of blaming and finger-waving and aggressive anger. And not a lot of light. I'm seeing a lot of heat generated on Twitter, and people kind of moving into sort of argumentative, angry positions very quickly without actually sort of debating or thinking about it.
The question is, does it work? Does it recruit people to get angry?
It tends to solidify the group, yeah. But it doesn't actually sort of persuade. So anyway, I can't say any of this better than Martha Nussbaum writes it, so I just would advise you all to go away and read it.
Excellent. Thanks for that, Ian. And thank you all for listening. And we'll see you soon on The Deep Dive.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.